Good morning, everyone. This is a momentous day for us. This is our first oral argument in person, everyone in person, since January of 2020. So I don't know if you feel lucky because you're part of that, but no one requested to opt out for the in-person argument. So that's good news. I'm very happy to see both of you here today. I'm joined, of course, with my colleagues, Judge Jerry Tao to my right and Judge Bonnie Bulla to my left. I know they're excited, too, to also be back to an in-person argument. Our first case comes to us via the pro bono program. It's Deshaun Prevost versus Kayla Grunvold, and this is a child custody matter. And we have Mr. James here representing the appellant and Ms. Labello for the respondent. And Mr. James, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. 3 minutes.
Okay, and this is case number 82916 COA. So you may, wait. Do you want to say anything, Judge Tao, before we start?
No, just thanks, everybody, and it's good to see everybody in person. It's been a long, arduous road for everybody. I'm sure your practices were all affected, but we're excited and looking forward to a good argument.
Thank you, Judge Bulla.
Welcome. We look right. Forward to hearing from you both. Thank you for being here.
Okay. All right, Mr. James.
Well, good morning, Your Honors. Judge Tao, Judge Bulla, and Chief Judge Gibbons. Peter James, 10091 for the appellant, Deshaun Prevost. And may it please the court. This is a case of a dad who was basically missed by the system. The trial court judge completely missed an issue. For reasons passing understanding, dad said unequivocally that mom's boyfriend put her into child prostitution when she was 14 years old. And the only thing the district court commented on was that someone later on in foster care did the same thing. Now, mom even addressed the issues in response, kind of. She said, "Dad just wants to make my boyfriend into some kind of predator." She didn't deny the allegations. She tangentially said, "Well, I never said those things." Well, this is a big allegation. This isn't one of numerous best interest factors that are slayed across and you forgot to deny one. This is your boyfriend is a pedophile.
Mr. James, let me interrupt you for a minute. Is there any evidence that the mother's current boyfriend, I'm not sure what their actual current status is, but the current boyfriend had inappropriately had contact with the minor child at any time? Is there, can you point to any evidence in the record that would support that?
No, there's no evidence in the record to support that because the child didn't spend a whole lot of time in Mississippi. And whatever happened, my client is completely unaware. Now, if I can go outside the record, I can answer more, but I believe I'm confined to the four corners of the record.
So your last comment, your client is completely unaware what happened in Mississippi or in Alabama where he might be living. So his statement that he is, that the partner and apparently the father of another child was a predator is based upon what Ms. Grunvold said.
Correct.
So in the normal case, it would be hearsay. It wouldn't even be allowed. Here it's a party opponent, so it would be allowed. But she denied stating it. So where does that leave it? He said she said it. She said she didn't say it. And what other evidence is there to indicate who's telling the truth about this?
Well, just because someone's dancing around a question. Well, I never said that. She didn't deny the allegation. Ever, not at the motion to stay hearing, not at any time did she say my boyfriend did not put me into child prostitution. Now that's something you need to affirmatively state. Like I said, it's not one of these little factors that just kind of get blown by And, you know, it's just one of the things. This is the central allegation.
Right. Now, these people were pro se, weren't they, at the district court?
Yes, they were.
If counsel had been there, I'm sure this question would have been probed. So you're indicating the judge sort of just let it slip by and didn't really get to the bottom of it?
Correct. That and at the motion to stay hearing. I mean, she just didn't care about the issue. I don't understand why. I can't explain her reasoning or thinking.
What about this? Ms. Grenfeld also said that Mr. Prebos put her into prostitution. So it's kind of like, all right, she says that about him. He says that about her partner now. But both might be unsavory individuals, and therefore I'm not going to make it the decisive factor.
Well, that really wasn't at issue at trial. I don't recall that in the record.
On page 10 and page 13, I believe, of the district court's findings, it talked about the allegations that Ms. Grunwald made against Mr. Prebos putting her into prostitution. He was her pimp. She was the prostitute.
Okay. That part, I'm thinking different what context
her,
here.
What her age was at the time, I don't know. You're talking about child prostitution, which is obviously far worse if that was the case.
Right. And not that it's condonable, but two consenting adults doing something together is one thing, even though it's illegal. Doing the same thing with a minor is much more egregious, especially since the child at issue here is now 8 years old, getting into the prime age for the kind of activities that mom's boyfriend engages in with child prostitution. So that's a paramount concern, is to protect the child.
Okay, let's just assume for a moment that you're right, the judge just glossed over it and didn't make a clear finding and determine what the best interest was, and that if that was the situation. Where does that leave us on this in terms of the big picture of the case?
Well, at a minimum, it needs to be remanded for further fact-finding. I would ask the court to find that her silence and not denying the biggest issue here would be to reverse and give my client custody here in Las Vegas.
Let me move away from this discussion for a minute and ask another question. There is a presumption that the judge made that domestic violence occurred by Mr. Prebos. And I'm just wondering if there is any evidence in the record that would suggest otherwise. Because once there's the presumption made, then, of course, the custody order makes some sense. Would you not agree?
I would disagree. To answer your first question, is there anything in the record to disprove it? Well, no, you can't disprove the negative. I mean, proving that something didn't happen is almost impossible
but
to do.
But we have evidence in the record, notwithstanding the exhibits where I know there's an issue. But we have her testimony.
Right.
And just to add to it, to use your point, did Mr. Prebos deny any of it? Or did he just say, well, we had some altercations and left it at that?
My understanding, Your Honor, is he did deny it, that he didn't hit her, he didn't beat her up, he didn't give her the bloody lip or the bloody eye or whatever it was that was in the photographs. He denied this.
Okay, I'm sorry I interrupted Judge Bola's question, but I just wanted to dovetail on it because it was your argument that it has to be denied.
And he did.
You're contending he did deny it. So back to her original point about the presumption.
So, and this is what I argued before the judge and the district court judge as well, is that let's just assume that the domestic violence happened, which my client denied, and her word, his word, I don't know how we get to clear and convincing evidence to do that, but the judge did. Now, with that, you have a choice. Someone who might have done some domestic violence on the mother versus the mom choosing to live with, which that is absolutely in the record. That was a finding of the district court that they're going to live together once trial is over. Who is a child predator who puts people in the child prostitution? Well, that's a no-brainer to me, that if he may have roughed her up a little bit, whatever, you know, he denies it. But putting someone into child prostitution is an entirely different ballgame.
But isn't the district court judge in the best position to listen to all the evidence and weigh the credibility of the party's testimonies?
Yes and no. And this is one of the issues that I raised on appeal. I'm raising it in multiple appeals because I believe the
Williams case most recently.
The court should review, and yes, Your Honor, the court should review credibility for an abuse of discretion. Now, you can make it an even higher standard, very strict abuse of discretion. But if I, hypothetical, if someone gets caught black and white lying five times during trial, but the trial judge finds that witness to be credible despite five counts of perjury, well, the reviewing courts are going to say, well, we just don't review credibility. And it's almost, I don't want to say, it's a bad standard. We need to review it on some level, because what district court judges are doing is they're trying to bulletproof their records and their orders by saying, well, the witness credibly testified, thereby making it not reviewable on appeal, and now their orders stand when they might not when they should be, reversed, but the court's just not going to review it.
Well, I mean, there's a reason for that, isn't there? Which is they can see the witness. They can hear the tone of voice. We can't. If somebody's sweating and their voice is quavering while they say something on the transcript, it's just going to say those words, but we're not going to see the sweating and the handshaking and the, and all that kind of stuff. But the district court can. That's why we defer to the district court on these things.
Well, you can defer. And if the record is like that, then perhaps maybe you should. However, there are circumstances where a blanket rule where you just don't review credibility is unworkable and untenable. I have a case right now where I caught the other side in three lies, but the judge made determinations based upon his credibility, even though he outright lied, black and white, ironclad proof. And I'm just looking at the decision saying, really? You can find this person credible after they lied three times at trial. So,
well, I mean, it's an interesting point. I see why you're arguing that, and I don't mean to dismiss it. I mean, there's some merit to it, even though it was unsuccessful in the other case I just mentioned. But how would it apply in this situation? You have two people testifying. One says something happened, the other says it doesn't. They go on to another point. One says it happened, the other says it doesn't. Doesn't the judge have to make some sort of credibility determination? And if it does, is it just inoculating the record, or is it resolving conflicting testimony?
Well, here's the problem with reviewing credibility in general. Take the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. You have one of the best actors in the history of film in Johnny Depp on the stand. He's going to be very believable. Amber Heard, not such a good actress, doesn't do such a good job on the stand acting. So who do you believe?
Well, if this had been a jury trial, the jury would have been instructed. A standard instruction is that if you find that a witness has lied about a material fact, you can disregard the entire testimony of the witness, but you're not required to. The jury still determines the weight and could find that somebody lied about something, but is truthful about something else. So, I mean, here, how's it different? Don't we give deference to the district court just like we would to a jury?
Possibly, but that would not be appropriate in this case because we have multiple lines of testimony that are at issue. One, mom not denying that her boyfriend was a child predator and put her into prostitution. Why not find mom credible when she said that? The judge is, she's picking and choosing which one she's going to find credible and which one she's not even going to address.
So how old was Ms. Grenwald at the time of the trial?
Ms. Grenwald, that I do not know.
Her... Certainly not a child. Way, way, way past being a child.
Correct. She was in her 20s.
Yeah.
So or like, early 30s.
Like 29 or so.
I believe so.
So, all right. Well, we've reached the 3 minutes if you want to retain it. But if there's any other point that you want to say really quickly that we need to consider or that you think Ms. LaBella needs to respond to.
Yeah, very quickly on the evidence. Dad served his exhibits, mom didn't serve the exhibits, and the district court judge forced dad into agreeing to an all or nothing, both or nothing, which was again egregious error by the district court. And this is prejudicial because mom had pictures and text messages that dad couldn't vet. She never disclosed it. She never gave it to him before trial. And the district court judge merely said, Mr. Prevost, you would like the court to examine your exhibits, wouldn't you? And he said, well, yes, Your Honor. Well, then we need to examine both. Now, I'm summarizing, but the testimony and the court's comments are very well laid out in the transcript, that it was an all or nothing, that if he wanted his, even though his were timely served, he had to agree to hers or it's not happening. And that is coercion. That is a forced deal. It was said in the order that Dad agreed to her exhibits, but he agreed under coercion by the court, which is wholly improper. On that, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
All right, you have 1.5 minutes left. Thank you, Mr. James. Morning.
Yes. Thank you, good morning. As you know, Michelle Labello, bar number 5527, on behalf of the respondent, Kyla Gronewald. Let me start with the comment about the evidence, because I don't see in the record myself any evidence that anyone served the evidence or their exhibits timely. And I think that's common in proper person scenarios. You're talking about a trial that was conducted via blue jeans to proper person litigants. I thought the judge did actually a very nice job diplomatically handling that issue when both parties had brought to the trial their proposed exhibits, and neither of them during the entire presentation of evidence offered any exhibits. So the court was aware that both of them probably intended to do that and didn't realize procedurally they needed to go through that, take those steps to actually offer the exhibit and have the judge rule on admissibility. So she diplomatically, at the close of evidence before closing arguments, asked them both whether or not that court should consider their exhibits. And obviously the respondent, my client, said yes, ma'am, and encouraged the judge to review everything. And the appellant, while he initially complained that the exhibits were not properly provided to him, he eventually did stipulate. And the words are very clear, and I just don't think any reasonable person could look at this record and say that the court strong-armed him. And the evidence throughout his testimony shows that the appellant is not the type of person that could be easily strong-armed. And again, the language of the court, when she very diplomatically said, let's discuss your exhibits, do you want me to consider them? The end of the discussion, the judge said, and this is in the appendix 2, pages 404 to 406 is where the reference to the trial transcript has this discussion. He said, are both of you stipulating that I may look at the exhibits? And my client said, yes, I would love for you to look at them. As well as Mr. Prevost, the court asks, yes, ma'am. So ultimately, even though there was some discussion initially of whether or not there was proper service, the appellant actually stipulated to those being admitted. And I did want to bring up one other point that's not in my briefing, because the reply brief mentions a case. Which is, the name is escaping me, so I want to make sure I give you the right citation. In discussing this is the discussion about service, I apologize. The case cited, I'm sorry, the name escapes me, I can't find it in my notes, but the case that was cited in the reply brief as to whether or not there was proper service, and I think the appellant asserts that improper service is non-service. So in the case cited by the appellant, it was a civil case that was on appeal, and an offer of judgment had been served in a case where both parties had counsel. And so that case is absolutely not analogous to the instant matter where you have pro per litigants. And in the other case, the civil case, we were talking about a statutory offer of judgment, and the ultimate ruling of the district court awarded fees based on an offer of judgment that was improperly served, and that's why the court reversed in that instance. That was service and a question of whether it was proper under NRC P5B. That is not the case here. And I think if you look at the record, there was an instance.
Ms. LaBelle, did the judge ever determine if Mr. Pivos had actually seen the exhibits?
She did not make a finding in that regard.
Did he ever claim that he didn't see them?
What the record indicated was that on cross-examination by my client, Mr. Pivos said, yes, I received your exhibits on the wizard. I could see what they were labeled. I could not open them. He said they were a PDF and I could not open them. And that is all I was able to find in the record regarding the exhibits. I don't see that the court relied much on the exhibits in her decision, honestly.
I mean, the one that stands out was a photograph or photograph showing injuries to her face that she claims from him beating her.
Yes. Yes, those I'm sure are the exhibits that would be most objectionable to the appellant.
Okay, and did he ever deny that he did those things?
I didn't see that he denied it. Not in his testimony at trial. He says a lot in his opening brief that I think wasn't in the record. I took issue with his.
So there's a lot of testimony about the domestic violence, and then you have these exhibits, and maybe they provide some corroboration. But I'm not seeing where the exhibits were the key to the case when the testimony from her described numerous incidents, and then there were other protective order documents that were submitted, and it's not totally clear from the record what those were. The judge makes some comments that they describe other incidents of domestic violence and the like. So I'm not sure if this is a discovery issue, an evidentiary issue, or again, the big picture question, how it changes the result if the judge did make a mistake or an error on this.
I totally agree, because the factor of the courts considering the allegations of domestic violence was one of the 0035 subsection 4 factors that she considered. And I felt like she was most concerned, right, about allegations that Dad wanted absolute sole legal, sole physical custody. So she was unable to find either under subsection 4C or D or E that it would ever be in the best interest for them to either share custody, physical custody, or for Dad to have primary physical custody, because Dad wanted absolute control. He had not facilitated contact. He was not going to allow meaningful association and a continuing relationship. And because they live in separate states, obviously, someone had to be awarded primary physical custody. And I don't think the decision solely relies either on domestic violence or, and I go back to the allegation, this trafficking that I keep reading, that the appellant never even testified at trial that mom's current significant other or others had put her into human trafficking. His testimony was that she was with someone that was a pedophile or pedophiles. And then the judge mentions in her decision that what she was most concerned about was mom's testimony that Jashawn had put Kyla into human trafficking. And again, she didn't make a finding whether that was true or not. But I think that, you know, you're supposed to lend more weight to subsection 4, factor C. And I think that's what the court did. And even if you did disregard the exhibits and the trafficking thing, I just don't see it in the record. I read it a few times. That was a few months ago, admittedly, and then I have prepared again. Obviously, I didn't get to read the transcript twice as I prepared for this hearing, but I don't see it. I think the appellant has misrepresented what the record says.
I mean, interestingly enough, the judge made all the findings about protecting the victim, meaning the mother and the child, from domestic violence going to Mississippi, and then, of course, doesn't talk about protecting the child from somebody else that would be in Mississippi. So, but the court made no findings that something like that happened, unlike it did make findings that domestic violence happened against her, against Ms. Grunvold, by Mr. Pivos. Therefore, the court was required to make a plan that would protect her and the child. And that's what the judge seemed to do.
But I agree with that. Yeah. And again, I don't think that the domestic violence was her primary paramount consideration. I think she gave each of the best interest factors the appropriate weight.
Well, she looked at all of them, but she provided the presumption. Back to Judge Bolla's question, if the presumption is applied, domestic violence occurred, you didn't rebut it, therefore I have to find X, and it's not rebutted. What, wasn't that really the overwhelming factor, even though there were other considerations?
I guess when I read the decision, every time the judge commented about the allegations that were contradictory to each other, you know, it just said, you know, that Jashawn denied those allegations. So I honestly am not sure I agree that the domestic violence and the failure of the appellant to rebut the presumption, I didn't see that as being the overwhelming factor.
Well, let's say it was the only factor. What would the outcome be? You have domestic violence. It's unrebutted. Does the abuser get custody?
No, absolutely.
So wouldn't
not.
That one factor outweigh everything else, even if there was nothing else?
If there was nothing else, it would, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, and here there are other things too.
Correct. And I do think that you have to go back to the issue of the credibility has to be determined by the district court.
Okay,
because you can't see, as Judge Tao pointed out, you can't see a person's demeanor when you're reading a transcript.
Right. But Mr. James's argument is, under most circumstances, what you and I just talked about would be the outcome. But he's saying this isn't the usual case. This is a case where the child could be put in another state and subject to a person that is possibly a pedophile or a sex trafficker. And that then could outweigh it, in without the, essentially there's no control. The child's 2,000 miles away, and who knows what's going to happen in this home.
Well, I guess I understand. I think that the court found incredible the allegation that mom would subject the child to a pedophile or someone who would put a minor into sex trafficking. I think the court found that was not a credible allegation.
Ms. LaBella?
If the court said that, I'd sure like to know that. I mean, the court seemed to not come out plainly say it, and that's why Mr. James is making this argument.
I'm sorry.
I apologize. I did not mean to interrupt.
Yeah.
So how long did the child live with Mr. Prevost before she was allowed to go live with mom in Mississippi?
It was almost a year. Mom left Las Vegas, I believe, on July 24th of 2020. And Jayliana was to go to live with her mother in Mississippi in July, I think July 1st of 2021.
So during the time that she lived with Mr. Prevost, were there, according to the record, are there any allegations that he in any way abused or hurt or injured the minor?
Not physically. There are allegations that he was not allowing mom to have contact or information, but not allegations, and I saw nothing in the record of an allegation or that would prove that.
It was just the contact, which of course is important, the parenting time between mom and her child.
Correct.
Thank you.
Do I still have 2 minutes and 23 seconds? So I want to talk a little bit more about the idea that the exhibits were admitted over what he claims is an objection, because that again is not reflected in the record. And the second argument raised by the appellant, the argument that the trafficker argument, again, I don't see that is what the testimony of dad was. And I outlined in my answering brief exactly what the dad testified to about what his concerns about mom's significant other. And he talked about her having a relationship when she was underage with this same gentleman. He complained about this gentleman is older, but he never ever testified that this significant other of Mom's had her go out and put her into trafficking. So I don't see that in the record anywhere, so I don't think that could be a basis to overturn the decision. I also absolutely disagree that Mom never refuted allegations made by Dad that her significant other was a pedophile, because she did absolutely testify when the court asked her about that, that no, I never said that. So that's important. And on the final argument, as far as whether or not this court is even allowed to examine credibility, if you decided, and the appellant admits his legal position is inconsistent with the law now, but even if you did, the trier of fact is the one, again, that has to be that is observing the evidence, observing the witnesses, and has to be the one to make that decision.
Mr. James gave the example of the other case he had where a person was caught lying several times. Is there any such comparison to this case? In other words, was Ms. Grenville never proved to be a liar?
I didn't see any evidence that she offered testimony that was clearly refuted by another piece of evidence, no. I think she did her very best as a proper person litigant, and maybe she didn't provide all of the testimony that she needed to, but no, I didn't see that there was anything that refuted what she claimed.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. LaBelle.
Thank you.
Getting the clock set right.
Just a couple of quick points. The photographs gave credence to Mom's testimony. Mom just said, well, I was beaten, but I don't have a photograph. I don't have a police record. I don't have a phone call. I don't have any doctor information. I don't have anything. Then it's kind of hard to believe someone when they say this. So the photographs gave credence, but the district court couched this as credibility, again, to avoid review. And if she had done it on the photographs, where there is a clear admissibility issue, should the matter go on appeal, which it did, then that would be weaker than couching it as credibility. Now, as far as the evidence, he did object. He didn't say, Your Honor, I object. That's a lawyer thing. He stated his objection, but Your Honor, I never received her exhibits. So basically, how can you admit them? That's good enough for an objection. So to say there was no objection is disingenuous. As far as Quinlan versus Camden goes, that's the service case. Improper service is no service. It doesn't limit it to there being two attorneys. It's improper service is no service, period. And there was no service of these. She sent it through our family wizard at some point, but not serving it. The way you serve trial exhibits is you bring books over in person and you hand them and you have them sign for them. We do this every single time we have trials. Yes, that's what attorneys do, but you need to give them the exhibits.
In a Blue Jeans case?
I'm sorry?
In a case heard over Blue Jeans, nobody's in court?
Yeah, we still did that.
Okay, so what about his exhibits to her?
He said he gave them to her and she never objected. She never said, I didn't do it, that she didn't get them or whatnot. So if the court would like anything further, I'm happy to continue.
Well, just to finish that, so she actually sent him the exhibits, according to Ms. LaBelle, through the family wizard, and he said he couldn't open them. So wasn't there some duty on him to object earlier so whatever the technology problem was could be resolved? Because normally you think if you get an exhibit by PDF, that would be good enough.
Right, but it wasn't through e-service. And e-service, you can now download it and open it. The Wizard app can be tricky, and that's not proper service. I mean, in the Quinlan versus Camden case, it was faxed over, and the attorney came to court and said, here, I got it right here, Judge, at the hearing. And the trial judge found that, hey, well, you got it, therefore it's service. And the Supreme Court said, no. There was no consent to service by fax. We don't care that the person got it at the time, right off the fax machine, understood it, saw it, came to court with it all upon the motion for the fees. We don't care. It doesn't legally exist. That's the holding in Quinlan versus Camden.
So in your view, then, Mr. Prevost could sit on his hands, wait till the end of the trial, then object for the first time.
It wasn't at the end of the trial when he brought this up. It's when the court brought up the exhibits and she wanted to admit hers, where he said, wait, I never got these. I never saw these.
Well, during the trial.
It was during the trial.
All right. That afternoon they were in court.
Yes. Because how would he know that she had exhibits to offer?
Well, he received it. He just said he couldn't open them. So at that point, you would make a call to your opposing counsel if there was one and say, hey, I can't get this. Can you resend it? Whatever. There would be some discussion about it. You wouldn't just ignore it.
Yeah, and the record is unclear when he got it. I do believe he said he got them very close to trial and didn't have time to properly vet them. And that's the issue, is properly vetting them. Because there are some things in there that we don't know were genuine, but they were admitted into evidence. Now, what the trial court should have done is either not admitted them or continued trial so he could review them.
Certainly not an ideal situation. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. James.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excellent work. Ms. Labello, thank you for taking this case pro bono and digging into the record and putting this brief together and making the argument today. Thank you very much for your efforts, too.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Is this a rewarding experience?
Yes.
Enough to do it again?
Oh, yeah. I think my last time I was here on a pro bono appeal was Judge Lewis' very first day.
Oh.
I don't know if you remember, but I
I hope that's good.
All right.
Well, glad to hear that you've taken a second one. You know, as you know, there are hundreds or thousands more cases out there that need attorneys and there are attorneys willing to take them. And it's really, we're really happy to see that attorneys of your caliber and experience are willing to take cases, and especially more than one. And we hope that you enjoyed it. We hope that you tell other people about this experience and try to encourage them to do it as well. There are a lot of people out there who need attorneys who can't afford them. Family law is a field that's ripe with this. As you guys know, there's so many pro se cases out there. And some of them have challenging issues and an attorney would help. So hopefully both of you will tell everybody that this is a good experience and try to get everybody else to take on some of these cases. It helps us. It helps the litigants. It helps the whole system out.
Well, I want to say thank you to both of you. Mm-hmm. You answered the questions. You knew your record. And I really do appreciate you all being here today in person. It's really nice to see everyone in a courtroom.
Right. So you were here. You have two landmarks, and you were here for Judge Bullitt's first argument, and you're here for our first argument in person in 2 years. So two landmarks for you.
Right. And Mr. James does a lot of appeals, so you're up against tough competition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I need to be there for a couple of years, so I don't
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll be in recess. Next case is at 11.